Hello, everyone. I'm joined here, as usual, by Jeff Bell, CFO, Mark Hodges, who's the Executive Director for the Consumer Division, Mark Hanafin for the Business Division, Sophie Fitton, and a number of colleagues who you know well are also here. So what I thought I'd do, if it's okay, is just to give a few headline messages, and then we'll open it up to questions. So last November, we signaled that the second half of 2017 was going to be weak, and therefore the year would also be weak. Operating profit was down 17% to £1.25 billion, and the main reason for the weak performance was in our business division and mainly in North America business, where we had a combination of significant changes to the marketplace multiplied by some changes that we were also undertaking internally, and that resulted in poor performance in the second half of the year. The consumer division was very resilient, and the consumer division, as you know, contains most of what you know as British Gas, both the engineers and energy supply. The consumer division's profit was £890 million, down 1%. The business division was £161 million, down 67%. And the asset businesses, including exploration and production, were £201 million, up 49%. In terms of where Centrica is today, we are halfway through a six-year repositioning of the company, which we laid out in 2015, and that repositioning is all about refocusing on the core of energy supply and services and developing a large number of new propositions, which we know customers want, and indeed there are some very encouraging growth rates on a number of our new propositions. And, for example, in the second half of last year, we grew accounts in our home services in the UK for the first time in a six-month period since 2011. And there are a number of other things that are growing. So it's not all in any way down. But at the end of the first phase, which we concluded at the end of last year, we've repositioned the portfolio. We've reallocated resources towards the customer. We've delivered on a major efficiency program of £750 million a year, 3 years early, and the balance sheet has been strengthened so that net debt at £2.6 billion is towards the lower end of the target we set for the end of 2017. In the next phase, I mean, as we build new skills and propositions which customers want, as I say, there are many encouraging signs of growth. And I'm sure that one area, though, that you will want to talk about is, well, what about energy accounts in the UK? And I'll touch on that, although I know Mark Hodges will be able to give you more detail. The headline is that we saw a reduction in energy accounts last year of 1.4 million accounts in the UK. That corresponds to 750,000 customers. And the important thing here is 70% of those losses were loss-making. About a million of those accounts actually lost us money even before overhead costs. About 200,000 of them were break-even, and so really the impact was on only 200,000 of them on higher margin accounts. Mark can touch on what were the drivers of that and why we are okay with that, but essentially we are, while we don't like losing any customers, clearly our focus is on selling energy to make a profit, not to make a loss, and I'm sure we'll get into that in more detail. The next phase to 2020 is all about performance delivery and financial discipline. And that's the performance side of it is all about growth in margin through our customer relationships. But secondly, also driving our efficiency as hard as we can. And that's to make us as competitive as we can. And we have announced a new efficiency program out to 2020 with an additional £500 million of annual efficiencies, And very regrettably, this involves another 4,000 job losses. And we've indicated, while we don't give a full breakdown, that you can look at the numbers and realize that the majority of those are going to be in the UK. Why are we driving further efficiency, having met our original target? Well, there are three drivers for this efficiency program. The first one is simply customer trends. Customers want to move more onto online and digital. That involves a different way of serving people. We believe that that will be more cost effective. That's one very big driver. The second big driver is obviously competition. There's a huge amount of competition, and we've got to compete effectively. And then the third driver is, of course, this imminent tariff cap in the UK. We've got to get ready for it. We've got to be as competitive as we can. And so these are the reasons why we're pursuing further reductions. And that will involve, by the end of 2020, therefore, a total reduction in our workforce of 9,500 people, but with an addition of 2,000 new jobs. And that 9,500 represents about 25% of the workforce as of the end of 2014. And then the final message, you know, looking forward financially, what are we indicating? And we've indicated today that in addition to a number of targets on cash generation, we expect to maintain the current level of dividend from Centrica out to 2020, provided, one, we are generating cash flows on average at 2.1 to 2.3 billion per annum, and secondly, that we maintain our net debt, so our balance sheet discipline, in a range of, 2.25 to 3.25 billion pounds. So we're maintaining financial discipline and driving performance and giving our shareholders certainty as best we can in the face of the uncertainty associated with the government's actions in the UK. Those are the headlines from my perspective. I'd now like to Holly to open it up to questions, and we'll be happy to go wherever you'd like to go. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad now. And if you change your mind and wish to withdraw your question, it's star followed by two. Our first question today comes in the line of Adam Vaughan of The Guardian. Adam, please go ahead.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, good morning, Ian. Is it fair to say to your shareholders that the worst is actually still yet to come, given that you've got the cap coming on millions of your customers and you've got that competition that you talk about becoming much tougher? You know, I'm thinking specifically of Empower, SSE, and, you know, now Shell in the market. How worried are you about those new threats, and what are you going to do about them?
Well, I'll leave the specifics of the competition in the UK energy market to a new entrance to Mark Hodges to talk to. I don't agree with the worst is yet to come. I actually believe the best is yet to come. But we have had to go through some pretty tough times in the last 3 years as commodity prices have collapsed. The government decided to intervene in this market. And as I said, we had had some performance issues in North America. But the thing that I would hold on to, and I do hold on to, Centrica's got a very clear strategy that's chasing after where our customers are going. And where our customers are going is they're wanting more than just energy, and they're wanting specific things that add real value to the relationship. And we can supply all those things and at scale. And we've built the capability to do it. That's what makes me very excited about the future, and Mark can talk to some of the great things that are actually going on. The second thing that gives me optimism is the strength of our cash flows, because they are materially strong, and we've just indicated that even with a price cap uncertainty, we'll be continuing to generate strong cash flows and able to balance, on average, the outgoings. Thirdly, I feel very good about the strength of our balance sheet. We have spent a lot of time selling things and driving cash flows so that our net debt is in a very solid place, able to support strong investment-grade credit ratings. And finally, the thing that makes me most optimistic is the quality of our people, the assets and market positions we've got. So I'm not being all rose-tinted. I'm just saying, no, I don't think the worst is still to come, although there's a lot of competition in the markets, and clearly this price cap thing is frustratingly uncertain. Mark Hodges, how does it feel in the UK market with all these new entrants?
Yeah, morning, Adam. So look, we have 67, I think, market participants now in UK energy. So it is a very competitive market. You know, our focus, as Ian has really outlined, is on controlling and working on the things we can control. So we're driving service levels up, complaints down. We're focusing on cost, which Ian's already mentioned. We're innovating in terms of new products and propositions. And really, we're playing to our strengths. You know, the great advantage we have is we're not just an energy company. We have a fantastic services business. We have a growing connected home business with a leading position here in the UK. So it's really the combination of all of those factors that makes me feel positive. And at the end of the day, competition is good for customers. You know, we've said consistently over a number of years that we welcome competition. It's good for customers. And fundamentally, that's why we're against the price cap. You know, we think in a competitive market where everybody's contributing the same to things like social and policy costs, we think our natural strengths, we think the work we've been doing to make our business more effective and more efficient positions us well.
Thanks, Mark. And I just say that the only thing I regret is the fact that we're going to see 4,000 more colleagues leaving Centrica. And it's partly, but not entirely, but partly, of course, due to this price cap, which we've just got to face down. But it's also due to competitive pressures, as Mark's outlined. Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next question today comes from the line of Rachel Morrison of Bloomberg. Rachel, please go ahead.
Hello,
morning.
Rachel.
Hi. I've got a few questions on the sale of the UK nuclear stake. Could you give a little bit more colour on your how you came to the decision to do that? I know you sort of flagged it previously. Could you also just explain about the decommissioning costs? I think that it's already taken into account with that stake that you pay sort of on a yearly basis. But if you could just explain that to me, that whether the person who you sell it to is liable for any decommissioning costs or whether you will still be. And can you tell me a bit more, is the deal sort of, do you want to sell it to raise cash, or are you sort of just relieving it from your obligation? And also, sorry, last question, how do you see the kind of universe of likely buyers for that? Do you think anyone will want it? Thank you.
Well, a lot of questions there, Rachel. I'd like to, in a minute, pass to Mark Hanafin to talk about the decommissioning cost issue and how that works. I mean, the headline is the following, Rachel. We signaled back in 2015, actually, that we were holding our nuclear position as a financial investment and treating it on that basis. The reason is that we got out of Hinkley Point C, the new nuclear station build, which I have to say we don't regret. But that meant that the strategic optionality of the existing fleet was limited, and we're running an existing fleet. There's no new ones being built for us, but we were obviously trying to make it as, you know, well run as possible. What was the thought process? Well, certainly it's not to bolster our balance sheet, because we've just got our balance sheet to where we wanted to get it. But it is really because we're not the natural owner of it, really, and it's a minority stake with limited control. And we think that there are probably going to be more natural buyers and owners for this this asset than us. So that's the rationale. What we've said this morning is that we're aiming to sell it, hope to sell it by the end of 2020. Why so long? It's not a simple equation at all. And we have to be very thoughtful about alignment with our partner and very sensitive to the interests of the UK government in this area. They've said nuclear is one of their special interest areas. So needless to say, we've been speaking to the government about it and making sure they're aware of our thoughts, and we will be doing so going forward. I'm not going to comment on the buyer universe except to say, look, there are very few strategic buyers around the world who have the capability to buy into nuclear, but there are an increasing number of infrastructure funds who are interested in reliable assets like this. So we'll see. It's very early days. But Mark, the setup and the decommissioning cost liability?
I think the simplest way to answer that is that when Centrica bought its 20% stake in the existing nuclear fleet, it did not take on the liabilities for nuclear decommissioning, and any sale that we make of our stake would not be passing those on either.
Thanks, Mark. It's very different to Germany, of course, where there's been a big controversy there, but the government holds on to the nuclear decommissioning liability. Rachel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next question today comes from the line of Angela Jameson of the Evening Standard. Angela, please go ahead.
Hello, Angela.
Thank you. Good morning, Ian. I've got two questions. I just wanted to go back to, you said that you regretted the loss of 4,000 jobs, and this was partly due to the price cap. How much would you blame the government's intervention, and how much would you blame competition in the marketplace? Because I'm just trying to gauge where you place the most blame. Is it really down to the government's intervention here that you're having to cut so many jobs?
Well, Angela, thank you. And first of all, congratulations to the Standard on a very thoughtful piece last night about price caps. I really do think it was very well thought through. Firstly, we're not blaming anybody. We're not in a blame game here. But we've got to respond. We're a business. We've got to respond to the circumstances. And as I say, there are three reasons that are driving this. The first circumstantial reason is an obvious one, customer trends, where we are seeing customers wanting new things from us, but also wanting them in a new way from us, particularly going digital. And so we've got to respond to that. And there are also trends using digital technology to make our field operations with our engineers more efficient. So there's a big, I'm not going to go into all the trends, but Mark Hodges can cover some of them, but there's a very big driver called where the customer wants to go. The second driver, as Mark Hodges also mentioned, is we've got very intense competition in all of our markets, but particularly in the UK. We've got 67 suppliers, most of whom lose money, but nevertheless, we have 67 suppliers. And the competition is fierce, and as somebody else just mentioned on the Adam mentioned a minute ago, there's consolidation going on, there's new entrants coming in, and so we've got to respond to competition. And the way to do that is to be as efficient as you can be. One of our goals is to become the most efficient price setter consistent with our brand and positioning. So the two of the three drivers don't involve the price cap at all, but the third driver is the price cap, and it's basically we've got to be mindful of three things. We've got to be mindful of our exposure to a price cap. We've got to be mindful of our competitive position in advance of a price cap, and we've got to drive our cost efficiency as hard as we can. And what we're laying out today is on the first one. This is why we are, at the end of March, withdrawing the standard variable tariff. And last year, we were able to net move 700,000 customer accounts from the standard variable tariff onto our fixed-term deals. That's really good indicator. And we've said today that we are going to move 1.3 million customers, we hope, off the standard variable tariff this year. So that will reduce our exposure because the tariff cap is a default tariff cap. The second thing on our competitive position, relatively, our standard tariff is already £41 below the average of the other large suppliers. And actually, it's £100 below some of the highest priced in the market. That means that other people are going to hurt first and more before us, as long as we maintain that competitive position. And then lastly, we are driving costs as hard as we can, and we think that's going to result by 2020 in about another £20 per customer. That way, we think we can handle, as best we can, a price cap without fundamentally making the business unattractive. So that's where we are. But let me see if that answers your question, Angela, first.
So, sorry, did you mean that by 2020 you'd be able to reduce bills by £20 per customer, or your cost to serve by £20 per customer?
Clearly, if you look at our track record, since 2009, our net profit after tax in UK home energy has been between £42 and £65. Mm-hmm. And last year it was £59. But we've been in a really tight range. And basically, what does that tell you? We pass everything else on to the customer and we make a consistent profit margin. That's our goal. So clearly, what we're trying to do is make ourselves more efficient, but we would expect that the price cap will have an impact on our gross margin. So we're absolutely getting ready for it, is the message.
Right. Okay. Just really quickly, you've said today that you're maintaining the dividend, but there's been concern about it. How long can you carry on that in that position? Are you confident that you can continue to maintain it?
So we've said we expect to maintain it out to 2020, subject to being able to produce 2.1 to 2.3 billion pounds a year of cash flow, and subject to keeping our net debt in a relatively tight band of 2.25 to 3.25 billion pounds. I mean, how does that work? I mean, essentially, if we make 2.2 billion pounds of cash flow and we spend capital of between 1 and 1.2 billion, call it 1.1, then there's 1.1 billion left over.
Yeah.
Our interest payments and our pension obligations probably account for half a billion. And our dividend, cash dividend payouts are about 550 million. And so if you do the math, it balances. And so even in the face of a price cap, although we don't know yet what the impact will be, we are expecting to be able to manage within those parameters and maintain the dividend for the next 3 years. Angela, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next question today comes from Sylvia Feifel of the Financial Times. Sylvia, please go ahead.
Hi, Sylvia.
Good morning. Hello. Hi. Sorry to harp on about the job cuts. Just given the uncertainty as to where the price cap will be, can you today rule out any further job cuts
going forward? Unfortunately, one can never rule out job cuts. I do want to make the point that although we are cutting 4,000 jobs in this efficiency program, we are creating new jobs in our new businesses. And we've created well over 1,000 new jobs over the last 3 years, and we expect to create another about 1,000 new jobs over the next 3 years. So net, I suspect the impact will be lower. So it's not all negative, but we can't rule out job cuts. And it's partly because the market's changing rapidly, and we've got to change with it. But our expectation is this 4,000 is about the right number over the next 3 years. We're not giving any forecasts beyond that. And you know, the majority of these will be in the UK. And unfortunately, look, our workforce, which is a great benefit to the country, actually, 80% of our workforce in the UK is outside of the southeast. So this is unfortunately going to impact people all over the country and in some of the more challenged areas of the country. But what we are going to do is try and leverage as much as we can natural attrition. We've switched our hiring practices, so we're going to try and fill job vacancies internally from internal candidates. And then, of course, if people are to leave the company, we're going to manage that exceptionally carefully with respect and dignity with good terms as we let people go.
Okay, thank you. I just had one quick other question, just in terms of the problems you had in North America last year. Did anybody in the top management lose their job as a result of happened?
So we are making some changes. We've still got some reviews to do about capability. But what actually happened in North America is very significantly an accounting error going back to 2013, which we corrected. That was half of it. And then of the other half, about half of it was down to external market changes. And then where we went wrong was we didn't have strong visibility of what was of some of the changes and how they were going to impact us. And so we are going to have to change some of our products. We are going to have to improve some of our processes and also bolster capability. So it's more about adding capability than chasing after whose fault it was. But we are going to have to make some changes.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question today comes from the line of Emily Gosden of The Times. Emily, please go ahead.
Morning.
Hello.
Sorry to go back to job cuts again, but just very simple yes or no. Are you making more job cuts than you would have done without the price cut?
Yes.
Fine. Okay, second question. Can you quantify that?
No.
Okay, all right. Your profits at British Gas Residential are actually up, despite this sort of weak group performance you're talking about. What is your profit margin at British Gas Residential, and how does that compare to the previous year?
Well, look, I think Mark Hodges and his team have done a great job in this last year. And as I said, a lot of the customer losses are down to removing loss-making accounts. But Mark, our profit margins...
So, Ian, I mean, it's entirely consistent with the range that you outlined earlier on the call. Historically, going back to 2009, it's been £42 to £65. This year, it's at £59. So the profit per customer, is very, very consistent. And how we've got there is a combination of some impact on gross margin as the market has been more competitive, which we'll talk about as we go through the day. But, you know, we have lost some gross margin due to the loss of the higher value customers. We've been able to offset that through the efficiency program we've been running over the past 3 years to come out with that kind of net result, which is only marginally down.
And Mark,
in percentage terms, can you clarify what your percentage profit margin, the way we've always quoted it, was for 2017 and what it was for 2016?
Off the top of my head, I can find it for you, Emily. But
well, Emily, if you think about it, after tax, I mean, £59 on £1,100. I mean, you know, it's
come down because the value of the bill has gone up. So, and the profit per customer is pretty consistent year on year. So the
but it's still about 5%. And Emily, the thing I'd encourage you to remember is that if you're looking at it on a per account basis, we have deliberately removed 1 million accounts that lost money. Clearly, that's going to, on your metric, it's going to increase the profit per account without changing the circumstances of the remaining customers. So, you know, just think, remember that we're actually losing, partly deliberately, customer segments that we don't want to renew, because they are actually loss-making, not only loss-making after costs, they're actually loss-making before costs. And just to really put it in perspective, 1 million, roughly, of those account losses last year had a gross margin contribution of negative £2 million. So basically, every one of them was losing us £2 before we then applied our costs. And that's clearly no way to run a business.
I'd be grateful if you could come back.
I can give you the number. It's basically 6% there or thereabouts for both years.
Okay. If you could send over the exact percentages, that would be very helpful, because I guess they probably have changed year on year if you could see what those are. If every one of those households was losing you £2 before cost, and that's no way to run a business, why were you running a business like that? You've been in charge throughout that period.
Well, actually, some of these go back some distance. That's the first thing. But also,
Emily,
we've been participating in collective switches, for example, where we are participating to bid for customer books, and we were bidding for them at break-even in the hope that we would cross-sell and upsell to the customers. that's a perfectly rational thing for businesses to do. However, as I've just evidenced, they were effectively break even, and we couldn't cross-sell or upsell to them because what we found is the collective switch customer just wants to do it again. They're only interested in energy. They're not interested in anything else. They're not interested in upsell. They actually don't mind who they get their energy from, and they're only interested in price. And so, you know, it's very rational to have thought about it. That's what a lot of the market are trying to do, build books through acquiring customers. But what we are not prepared to do, and, you know, a lot of people in the market have been doing this, is acquiring customers at really aggressive rates, and then when some of them are not looking, put them onto a really high standard variable tariff. And if you look at some of the cheapest people in the market, £840 roughly, they've actually got some of the most expensive standard tariffs, and we've said we're not going to do that. So there are a number of different changes. We also got out of door-to-door selling in North America. It wasn't all in the UK. But you're right, we've said over the last 18 months, we're going to focus more strongly on customer value and giving customers value as well as giving us value, and not just volume. And I'd encourage you also to focus on that. But Mark, anything you want to add?
Well, only just, Emily, to remember the dynamics of the market. The market's changing very, very rapidly. We have been focused much more heavily over the past 18 months, which we talked a lot about last year, on segmenting the customer base, understanding the behaviors of different customer groups across different dimensions, whether that be consumption, whether that be debt, whether that be propensity to churn, whether that be propensity to buy another product. You know, and that level of sophistication is increasing in our business, frankly, all of the time. So with a rapidly changing market, with us, I think, increasing our capability and skill set in the whole world of segmentation, you know, we will adjust our course naturally as we move forward. I think it's an entirely natural thing for us to have done.
Thank you, Emily.
Thanks.
Sorry, Emily.
I wondered if I could just ask one more, which is, although you've said that you don't need to sell the Nuke stake to bolster your balance sheet, it's more that you're not the natural owner of it, but your balance sheet might be fine now, but is this not partly driven by concerns your balance sheet might not be fine in the next couple of years if the price cap comes in?
No, it's not driven by that, in the sense that our balance sheet is strong and our range for the next 3 years of net debt is slightly wider than we were indicating at the end of last year. So it really isn't driven by that. But clearly, if we're not the natural owner of it, we can use any cash proceeds both for the business and you know, other obligations that we have. So it's very, very much driven by a strategic decision, which actually we announced in 2015.
Okay, thanks.
Emily, thanks very much.
Our next question today comes from the line of David Craik of the Daily Mirror. David, please go ahead.
Hi, David.
Hello there. You mentioned there about some of these customers, and you partly deliberately didn't want them to remain. Does that mean that you've closed their accounts, or have they just switched, or how does that work?
So I'll pass to Mark. I just want to say one thing, that we don't like losing any customer. I just want to be clear, but we concluded we couldn't actually get value in any way from those segments. But Mark.
So David, yeah, these are customers who will have switched away, you know, in terms of as they've looked around the market and sought new deals. And we could have chased after them. I mean, we could have chased those customers, but actually it would have been a very, very expensive act for us to pursue those customers into the open market. And so for that group, you know, we decided that it was the most economically rational thing to do was to let them move into the open market, and for us to focus on the customers with whom we have a deeper relationship.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and in terms of perhaps why they switched, and perhaps why the higher value customers have gone, is that just down to perhaps some of the price rises that you brought in last year, or are there other factors there?
Well, I think switching is up generally in the market. We see various statistics that evidence that more and more people are looking at their energy supply relationship, and switching has been increasing. I mean, it's one of the reasons we worry about a price cap, because it may have the opposite effect and we may see less switching. But that's the biggest factor. More people thinking about their energy supply relationship is pretty much constantly in the news. So people are is constantly brought to people's attention. I would see that as the biggest single reason for those customers deciding to move elsewhere.
And David, this is Ian. I mean, just to add one thing, one of the things that we are doing, which may surprise people, is that instead of keeping all of our customers on standard variable tariffs and not, you know, trying to avoid them churning away, we're actually encouraging them to go onto different tariffs. And we succeeded in moving 700,000 accounts last year onto fixed term deals. We're also seeing customers wanting bundled deals. They want their boiler servicing as well as energy. We're offering Hive with energy and discounting the energy. We've got the loyalty program out there, which is reducing churn. So really, we're going to a different place in this market. And we're very satisfied that the actions we're taking are the right ones that will improve things for the customer. We don't think that a tariff cap is actually going to be a good thing. You only have to look at university tuition fees to see what happens when you get a cap. Or if you look at the prepayment cap that's been brought in for energy last year, where basically most of the prices are within £10 of each other. So we think it's a bad thing, but we've said everything we can say, and we're just going to get on with doing the right thing, doing the right thing for the customer. Thank you, David.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question today comes from the line of Rachel Millard of the Daily Mail. Rachel, please go ahead.
Hello, Rachel.
Hi, morning. Hi. I just wondered, I expect there are some people out there that would have preferred you to save costs by cutting the dividend rather than cutting jobs. And I wonder if you can explain why you've put the dividend ahead of jobs. And also, how many compulsory redundancies are you expecting out of those 4,000?
On the second part, we actually don't know the answer to that. I hope as few as possible, but there will be some, clearly. We have to, first of all, as I say, manage through natural attrition and churn, and also try and maximize the number of internal jobs that we fill from internal candidates if they've got the qualifications to do the other job. But there will be some redundancies. On the main part of your question, I am deeply conscious that we have multiple obligations to multiple groups of people, including our employees. And our employees are about giving them a sustainable future in a company that can start to grow. And that's what our strategy is all about. However, as the world changes and as circumstances change, unfortunately, and you see this in many markets at the moment, digitization and change of the competitive landscape involves, you know, reducing jobs and cutting costs. And that is part of what we have to do. But the other obligations we've got that we take really seriously are to our pensioners and our, you know, pension deficit, which we've got to make sure we manage carefully. And, of course, to the people that have given us debt, and also our shareholders. And I think we've got that balance about right. And as I said earlier, that they're not in conflict with each other right now. But clearly, that we don't. This is not an active trade-off between dividend and job losses. We're not cutting people's jobs to pay the dividend. We're cutting people's jobs in order to be most competitive in advance of this price cap and in the face of some pretty difficult competitive pressures.
We have a follow-up question from Emily Gosden of The Times. Emily, please go ahead.
Hi again. You said some of the job cuts sort of make sense because you're you know, changing your customer proposition, you're going online, you're doing what customers want. But then if you look at the job cuts which you're doing as a result of the price cap, you told me you're doing more than you would have. Does that mean you're cutting deeper than you wanted to? And if so, is customer service going to suffer? Are you having to sort of row back on your offering to customers?
Well, firstly, we're cutting deeper than we were originally planning to. That is true. I gave you a very black and white answer to that question. And it's regrettable, but, you know, if our margins are under more pressure than we thought they were because of a price cap, we have to find ways to drive costs down as hard as we can. But on the matter of customer service, I'll leave Mark to comment, but the answer is no, we're not going to damage that. But Mark?
No, that's the answer. I mean, I think we've proven over the past 3 years that we can actually reduce costs in a number of our businesses, all of our businesses, and improve service. Those service metrics, we obviously look at net promoter scores. We look at the level of complaints. That's perhaps the best indicator, and they are down substantially every year over the past 3 years. So my view is that we can continue to make ourselves cost effective. That allows us to be price competitive, and we can continue to improve the levels of service we offer.
Well, Emily, okay, so the government... I was going to say, we did say in 2015, Emily, that our original cost efficiency program of £750 million a year, we would safeguard things like safety, compliance, and customer service. And as Mark said, we've delivered that £750 million a year 3 years early. And our complaints last year in UK home energy were down 20%. That's the same in all of our energy businesses around the world, 20 or more. And furthermore, I think I'm right in saying our complaints are now down 50% from where they were 3 years ago, and our net promoter scores are up. So I consider that to be a proof point, if you're looking for one, that we can walk and chew gum. It's not easy, though, and I'm not saying there will be no customer impacts by error. We do always have challenges during change, but that's our goal.
But if you're saying that you can maintain the same standard of customer service while making all these efficiency savings, doesn't that basically show that the government and the CMA were right, that you were very, very inefficient?
We admitted that we weren't as efficient as we needed to be. We said that very clearly in February 2015. We even showed a picture of it for the first time and said we were off the pace by about £30 per customer at a time when we had 10 million customers, and that equated to £300 million. And we admitted it at the time. That was part of our £750 million program. So, yes, we were not efficient enough, but we're a lot more efficient now.
So will customers see any benefit from you becoming more efficient in terms of their prices?
Well, they already have. If you look at our standard variable tariff, it's £41 cheaper than 85% of the market. Well, it's cheaper than 85% of the market and £41 cheaper than the large suppliers and some of the very small suppliers that are at £1,201, we're £100 cheaper.
Okay. And just on the nuclear state, are there any restrictions over who you can sell it to? I mean, there's been enough concerns about the Chinese coming into new nuclear plants. Could you sell the existing stake to Chinese, Russians, anyone?
Well, look, clearly, Emily, we have to be very thoughtful about this. And our partner needs to be, they own 80% of the business. They need to be happy with who the new buyer might be. And the British government has indicated that they treat nuclear transactions as a special interest area, and that they would therefore reserve their right to want to be satisfied. Therefore, of course, there are going to be things that we're going to have to manage carefully, and the buyer universe is small. I mean, there's not many people that can wander up and say, I'd like to buy a nuclear power station and I'm sure you'll trust me to run it. So you're absolutely right that, you know, but there's lots of things we've got to do, which is why there's 3 years that we're signaling for this. It'll take time. I've already been in touch with the government about it. They're very calm about it. They just want to be kept informed, and they want us to work with them.
And would you return the proceeds of a sale to shareholders if you don't need it from your balance sheet?
So, look, I mean, when and if we sell nuclear, at that time we will decide what is the situation of the company, how strong is the balance sheet, what are the balances between, for example, spending it more on our strategy, giving some of it back to shareholders, giving some more of it to our pension fund. We'll obviously have to decide at the time what the right thing to do is, and we're not giving any signals of what we're intending to do at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I think, Holly, we're near the end here. Are there any other questions?
We actually have no further questions registered.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I'd just like to say on behalf of my colleagues, and I'm sorry to Jeff Bell that I answered the question on the balance sheet and therefore didn't give Jeff a chance to talk, but thank you all for your interest. It's not been an easy situation that we found ourselves in, particularly with the uncertainty around this price cap coming in. However, uncertainty will pass, and as I said in the answer to Adam's question, no, I don't think the worst is yet to come. Actually, the best is yet to come. It's a complex set of markets we're in, but our job is to serve customers, and we're learning and developing ways on how to serve customers better and in new ways, using new technology and giving them what they want. And that's what Centrica is all about, and we look forward to updating you all at a later stage. Thank you all very much. Thank you all very much. Thank you all very much. Thank you all very much.